Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're about to listen to an interview which our socios enjoyed in full 12 months ago. If you'd like to listen to these exclusive monthly big interviews on the day that they're released, it's time to join us. That means supporting us. It means the price of a pint per month. Go to Patreon, patreon.com/GrahamHunter. Go now, join and become a socio. That means you'll get that extra big interview every month and you'll also unlock our entire archive straight away. All for £2.99 a month. It's the best deal in town, baby. And we need you. Whenever I watched David Weir, what shone out was that he was from an older school of Scottish football because he was bright. He read games terrifically. He made sure that his career was long, not simply because he ate, what was Gordon Strachan's recipe? Bananas, porridge and honey and nettles? No. David Weir didn't simply stretch and yoga his way to a long career. It was his brain. But he was also ferociously competitive. And in my eyes, as well as liking him, talking to him regularly, meeting him on the European scouting circuit, in my eyes, it was a picture book story, a boy's own story. To be, in his own words, not good enough for professional football at age 18. To go to the United States, to land there in the kind of circumstances which would have made an extra plot for the writers of Gregory's Girl or That Sinking Feeling or Local Hero. To survive that, to thrive, to become the elite of American college soccer, come back, knock on the door of his local club, be picked, graduate to winning trophies in Scotland, make a huge career in England with Everton, a mighty club with a proud support, and to tell us, to be able to tell us about characters like Duncan Ferguson, Tommy Gravesen, Kev Kilbane, Walter Smith, to tell us what it was like to play against Robbie Keane or Freddie Kanute, the great strikers of that Premier League era. David Weir is as good a storyteller as he was a match reader. But then, to end up at the club he always supported and to go to a European final with them, well, what that makes is a really good story. We went to his home, we sat down with him, he relaxed, and he told us all about it. Here it is. Everton, what Everton is a grand club, you know, a real traditional club. Goodison's a fabulous place. Yeah. People might say now, was it too small? Should we build? Do we need more crowd? But it's a fantastic stadium. Also, the people there. Yeah. It's, in all my career in England, and it was really unfortunate in that I would have reported when I was living and working in London on Howard Kendall's struggles, I think Walter coming in and saving them, saving them from desperate situations, last day escapes. But try and sum up Everton and its personality and its character as far as you're concerned.
It's an unbelievable football club, Everton. You know, it's hard to, if you don't know Everton or you've never been a part of it, or never actually, you know, been there or played there or whatever your interaction with is, you don't really understand. It's perceived as a second club in Liverpool by a lot of people worldwide, but within Liverpool, it's you know, David Moyes sort of coined the phrase, but it's the people's club, you know. So all the postcodes of the season ticket holders are Liverpool postcodes. You know, they genuinely, you go into the city, which I love doing, you go in and you meet proper people. I watched Tony Bellew, you see Tony Bellew, celebrity fan, you can just, that is the Everton fan. It's such a sort of true representation of what the Everton fans are. It's never far away from their thoughts. They genuinely care about the club, love the club, and have generations of families who have supported the club. So I didn't know at the time, being honest. You know, I knew Everton was a good name, a successful club, and Walter Smith was the manager, which was obviously a great attraction for me. But I was so lucky in terms of getting the opportunity to go and play for a club like that. And I had 8 years of initial struggles with Walter, as you said, because Walter was keeping the club afloat, keeping the club in the Premier League, which at the time was a success.
It's a giant achievement.
A giant achievement, because the odds were stacked against us. The players, in a lot of cases, probably including myself, weren't good enough. So we had to get better, and we had to survive, and we had to constantly bringing in players and then selling them straight
away. Well, Walter's been a guest in this, and you know, told us in no uncertain terms, and told me at the time too, that he'd been misled about what money he would have.
Yeah.
And even then, in that Premier League, if you didn't have the budget to compete, then you were on a wing and a prayer. And I think his work and the job he did has been misunderstood and underappreciated.
I think it's been appreciated by the Evertons. It's funnily enough, and I can remember one of the more recent dinners, Bill Kenwright, obviously the chairman and, you know, Everton's number one supporter, fan, and sort of barometer on everything, was, you know, invited Walter to the dinner and basically explained that, and, you know, the great way that Bill does in terms of what Walter did for the club and how the club has gone on from that base that Walter gave it. You know, the stability and going out of the league and where it might have ended up if that had been the case. And I think that's, you know, Evertonians being Evertonians, they'll understand that, you know, in terms of what Walter did bring to the club and what, how important that was at the time.
So for you, given all that your personality is perfect for them, was it always sweetness and light with Walter and Archie?
It was just, again, another experience. Because Walter and Archie were, you know, bad cop at times. You know, they generally were, you know, you were left in no uncertain terms what was required. Well, Archie went from the most mild-mannered, entertaining, best of company in pre-season on his trips to Chocó, where he obviously loved
Chocó in Italy.
It's beautiful countryside, and you know, Archie's at his best, totally engaged and totally buying into the working you really hard, but you know, also good times and good laughs, and then the game starting, the trouble starting, and then all of a sudden Archie's got you pinned up against the wall, and you're the worst player that's ever played for Everton, and you'll never play again. And you know, that's kind of how it went, the extremes and the emotions that were involved. So it was, you know, a real learning experience and a real tough league at the time, you know. It's not, it didn't have the circus surrounding it the Premier League had at the time, but every team you played against had good centre-forwards, two good centre-forwards, good partnerships, and, you know, every game was a test. It was a real good quality league and a real test in terms of professional.
So that says you're centre-back, predominantly centre-back. Yeah. So which tests did you hate and which tests did you go, I really love playing these guys, this guy, that guy, that pair?
I always loved playing, you know, like, for me, going to Old Trafford, going to Anfield, going to Highbury, as it was at the time, White Hart Lane, which is a great stadium, one of my favourite stadiums, probably only Goodison that I like more. So getting to go to these stadiums, that I enjoyed all that, but then you're playing against York and Cole, you're playing against Sheringham, you're playing against Robbie Keane, you're playing against Henry, obviously at different stages in the league, but Dion Dublin, you know, Alan Shearer, Les Ferdinand, you know, you're playing against, every week you're playing against a top striker or a top strike partnership. And, you know, the ones I found particularly difficult, you know, were the really tall ones. Everybody always thinks, oh, he's tall, he's a bit slow, he maybe not like the small quick ones. I didn't mind that. It was the ones, it was the Canutis and the, you know, the one shots.
Canute is a very good player.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a very, very good footballer.
And I found those really difficult. And you know him, obviously, and but he wasn't considered to be the best of the best in the league. And Paolo Wanchope was the same. He was a fantastic player and a real handful.
So I'm in the German World Cup, scoring a bosker of a goal as the Allianz Arena was being inaugurated, Costa Rica, Germany, and his pace, and he was relatively powerful, nice technical.
Yeah. Good that footballer. Was a different challenge every week, but those were, I felt personally, were the hardest. But, you know, playing against Leeds and playing against Robbie Keane or Viduka or Hasselbank or whoever it may be at that time. So every challenge was different and brought, you know, different problems.
What would you do as a sort of leader and a centre half? Would you plan? Would you go and study? Were you a big thinker during the week, or was it just like, I know what this is going to be like, and just turn up, make the best of yourself?
No, I think the game was evolving then as well. So particularly when David Moyes came in to manage, you begin to get more information. Walter probably concentrated more on his team in terms of what he wanted us to do and how he wanted us to do it. Mm-hmm. David Moyes probably spun it and it was more about the opposition. This is what they're going to do, this is what we need to do to counter it. So that probably changed in that respect, in terms of you knew more about the, obviously you knew the opposition because they were public figures and you watched them on TV and things, but the actual detail that David Moyes went into in terms of the opposition made, you had to become a student of the game.
I'm guessing you soaked that up.
Yeah, you do. You try and utilise it as best you can. You're trying to, because you're trying to stay in the team. And that's how it was. Mm. You know, David's team, he did get investment and he was bringing in players and seemed to be a centre-back coming in every year who was challenging for...
Is that what it felt like?
It did, yeah. It felt like there was... Per Kroldrup came in, Joseph Yobo came in, Matteo Ferrari came in. You know, Phil Jagielka came in, Julian Lescott came in. Mm. So, you know, over my 6, 7, 8 years there, Marco Materazzi, it seemed like there was centre-backs coming in every year and you had to fight for your position, which is right, you know, and you've got to embrace that challenge, you've got to enjoy that challenge, you've got to use it to make you better, and whatever the means may be, whether it's studying opposition or whether it's making yourself better.
You made me laugh because Steve Cutner told me that Materazzi had told him that after a bad first half at Everton, he was Materazzi of Zidane fame, was scared to go in. Scared of Archie, not Walter, but of Archie. Yeah. Now, that tells you a little bit about what you were explaining earlier on about bad cop, also two very, very, very funny men. When they handed over to David, one of the things, that I think his first season was a stabilising, finding the pace of the league, his first senior managerial job too, in terms of top level. That season where you finish fourth is as good as a trophy as far as I'm concerned. You know, right now, the Everton half of Liverpool wouldn't work for a month if they got fourth. It was a big, big achievement in a time where I think it was probably Mourinho's first season or at or around his first season. Rather than looking at game by game, your team was full of pretty good characters. Wouldn't you have played against Duncan Ferguson very early in your Scottish career for Falkirk? So take me from the Duncan Ferguson then to Duncan Ferguson that you encountered at Everton.
Well, my debut was against Duncan for Falkirk. So he was playing for Dundee United, my debut against Dundee United at Brockville. So that was my first introduction to Scottish football, playing against Duncan. And I still speak to Duncan now, still see him now and again. And, you know, he talks about that, how I was this fat kid with really small shorts playing in the game against him. And he was being watched by Bayern Munich in that game. And that's where he was going. So he basically made my career. So that's kind of his take on it.
How was it for you up close and personal?
A handful. You know, he is...
He's a really good footballer, I think.
He's a top footballer. He can do everything, or he could do everything, you know, in terms of he could run. His technique was fantastic. He could finish. He could head it, you know, left and right foot. Aggressive. You know, if he wanted to have a fight, he'd have a fight. If he wanted to play, he could play. So he genuinely had everything, Duncan. Maybe not quite the luck to enable his body to do what he wanted to do as often as he would have liked, but attribute wise he was at the top level. And I didn't play against him a lot because he was at Everton, and then when we were playing against him, or when Everton were playing against him when he was at Newcastle, I don't think it was his favourite game. So I don't think he was ever at his best when we were playing against him at Newcastle, which was few and far between. So he was a great teammate to have. He wasn't playing regularly or playing week in, week out, but he was a fantastic weapon. And he always seemed to raise his game in the bigger games. So if it was Manchester United or it was Liverpool, and it was a game where he felt he had to perform, or, you know, the spotlight was on him, he raised his game, and he was unplayable in some of those games.
That's a good phrase. I think that's right. I think there are a few players across my time watching football where you're like, well, on that form, that guy, and not just the quality forwards you've got, brilliance, David Villa, for example, Raul, whatever, mm-hmm. the guys who've got that talent, and they'll beast you as well. Yeah. That's a frightening sight to see. And across my, whatever, nearly 30 years now reporting football, Duncan would be up there with the people who, boy, some centre-halves must have just bricked it, absolutely bricked it.
You could see it, you could actually, you know, visually see the lads shrinking in terms of what they were going to face. And you saw it in the dressing room before the game with Duncan, you could see, you know, if he was captain, he'd act like a captain. He'd be in the dressing room, be talking to people, and it would gradually build. You know, you could feel the actual, you know, his demeanour getting into the dressing room. He was getting more and more excited for the game. He was building it up. So by the time you actually walked out the tunnel or walked out the dressing room, you were at fever pitch. You thought you were going to war, because he'd actually created such an environment in the dressing room. It didn't happen a lot, but you could just tell when he was in the mood, or when he was at the stage where he was ready to perform, and you could see it happening. And by the time, you know, he got on the pitch, he was just ready to unleash on whoever was unfortunate enough to be playing against him on that
day. It's a great sight. It's what football's supposed to be. It's a great, great sight. Rules have changed. I'm not sure that even a fully fit Duncan Ferguson would have as much profit today.
No.
And I worry a little bit about that. You know, I think that the game's not necessarily gone soft, but when keepers are overprotected, I'd love there to be, you know, six or seven Duncan Fergusons scattered across Europe. Yeah.
But still, the thing about it, Duncan will always be remembered, I think, for his physicality and aggression and, you know, what he brought. But technically, he could have handled it as well. That was the thing, because he was such a good footballer.
He was a very good player. Yeah, let's go across other characters, and you butt in and take me to players I haven't thinking of, but because I like him very much, and I think he was a little bit underestimated. Kev Coban has been a guest on our season. He's turned into a right good analyser, commentator. He's got a bright brain, real character of a man too. Either him, the guy, the dressing room, the training ground, the player. Tell us about playing with Kev Coban.
Just a really good fella. Just a genuinely, like, hard-working, honest, you know, team player who would always put the team before himself. You know, and as you say, made a really good career as a broadcaster. I love listening to him, and, you know, he genuinely has got a good insight on the game in terms of, he cares about it, he thinks about it, and he can explain it. But he's, as a teammate, he was exactly the same. He cared, you know, he wanted to win. He was very aggressive, but he was also, you know, very honest in the things he did. And that was that successful Everton team. You know, you could look at each and every individual and probably say, probably need a little bit better than that, you know, myself included. But when you had, you know, Kevin Coban's, you had Lee Carsley's, you had Steve Watson's, you had Alan Stubbs, you had Tim Cahill was talented undoubtedly, Arteta's and people like that. But when you had that solid base of these sort of solids, Nigel Martin, you know, good solid citizens who, you know, would turn up week in, week out, were responsible for themselves but for others as well. And Kev's probably typical of that, you know. He was a really good, solid professional who, you know, was a six at worst and a, you know, an eight or a nine at best.
It's valuable. There's one that needs to be mentioned, because it looked, and again you might dispel this myth, it looked as if his move midway through a very good season changed things. Tommy Gravesen. Apparently now he owns the world or runs Las Vegas. I don't quite know what it is. So he's obviously changed from the mild, unassuming character he was in your dressing room. I'm told he was absolutely crackers.
He was. And he was a Walter and Archie signing. You know, Thomas Gravesen came in, signed by Walter and Archie, and he was a complete maverick, you know, in terms of both as a person, you know, on and off the pitch. He was, you know, if you got him at the wrong time, you couldn't speak to him. He was just, the barriers were up and you just couldn't communicate. But when he was at his best, he was unplayable. He was genuinely, you know, day in, day out in training, in the possession games, the boxes, he was the tidiest, you know, best player in terms of keeping the ball that I'd played with. You know, just the actual technical qualities he had and the concentration that when he was on it to actually do the right things time after time was incredible. And he was a big part of that team which was, you know, the complete opposite of that. He was almost like the, you know, the difference to actually give us the opportunity to achieve what we achieved, because the others were probably incapable of it.
He wasn't the most usual Walter player in that he was somebody who positionally maybe wasn't so disciplined, yeah. but he could do clever little things to open up games.
Yeah. He was very frustrating, as in my
Till every year.
Yeah. In terms of what you'd want from a midfielder.
Tommy!
Where are you? Where are you going? Get back. But Lee Carsley was the opposite. So there was a nice balance in there in terms of how the team was. And Tommy would always do something in the game that made you realise, well, it's worthwhile having him.
I'll give him that long leash.
Exactly, yeah. So it was a small price to pay on a lot of occasions, although, you know, very, very frustrating in terms of, you know, where he expect him to be a lot of the times.
What about the other side of his character? Was he a Gaza style, letting off fireworks?
Yeah, he was. He's, you know, lots of stories about Tommy. You know, I played against him in Glasgow as well, you know, Rangers v Celtic, but playing with him in Everton and some of the games, and off the pitch, an absolute loose cannon. You know, terrorising the staff. So, such a strong boy, just pick up staff, you know, have them in a lock of some sort, and they just couldn't move. And, you know, just putting people in positions they shouldn't be in, and, you know, making people realise how sort of in charge he was going to be if he wanted it. So he was a real complex character and a real, like, loose cannon in terms of day in, day out. Some days you couldn't actually get a message across to him because he wasn't in the mood, and then some days he'd be the most engaging, likeable, funny guy that you've ever seen, and other days he'd be firing fireworks across the training ground at fizzers jogging around the pitch. And, you know, he was just absolutely nuts, but again, a really good footballer, a really talented footballer who, you know, moved to Real Madrid from Everton, which, you know, not a lot of people would make that move.
So tell me about Arteta, you've mentioned. Just right, good quality. If I'm not wrong, Arteta must have been one of the high quality organisers, thinkers, in terms of his midfield role that you played with. He'd been foreign player of the year in League One. I know he'd done quite well for Big Ali at Rangers as well, but when he comes in, the things I want to ask you, what made him stand out? And if he's to go on and manage, would that surprise you?
It wouldn't surprise me, because, you know, he's obviously got such a great understanding of the game. And when he played for Everton, a lot of the time, definitely initially, played sort of off the side more. So he'd have to probably think he's a central midfield player, which he was and is. But, you know, David Moyes used him slightly differently, playing off the side, and he had to make himself really important in that role. And he did. You know, he understands the game. He understands players he's playing around, and he always impacted the game. He always created something, made something happen, and made the game in general look easy.
In the Premier League, were there lots of midfielders who like to keep the ball like him, or be careful with the ball like him? I guess you could immediately look at goals and whatever, but across the Premier League in midfields, wasn't there a little bit more rashness about let's have a go at something rather than keep and move and turn? And
there was. It was very much about, you know, midfielders, you're either a defensive midfielder or an attacking midfielder. You know, that seemed to be the case. So you'd have the sitters, the Lee Carsleys, the ones who would sit and protect the back four, and then you'd have the ones, you know, Lampard, obviously, you know, of that level, who'd go and score 15, 20 goals a season, pulse goals, and people like that who are great passers. So there was a real mix of real good quality players across, you know, lots and lots of good teams, Vieira and people like that, you know, top players. So it seemed to be that, you know, there was loads of different attributes wrapped up in all these different people and just different challenges. Scholes was, in my experience, was just a different level in terms of, you know, what he could do, and he could do probably everything, you know, at different stages of career, and at his best probably do all of it at the same time. He could pass, he could score, he could, you know, he could run the game, he could dictate the tempo of the game, and he could really, you know, just pass you to death when he wanted to.
As a passionate Scot who wore the jersey so many times, did you have a laugh that England didn't know what to do with him? When you're watching this week in, week out, or having to go up against them, and they're like, yeah, I'm not sure what to do with this fella.
Well, to be honest, Scotland played England in the playoff for, it would have been Euro 2000, and he played the game at hand, and he scored two goals. And he knew what to do. They knew what to do on that day, so... I was in awe of him. I just thought he was a fantastic player. You know, I just thought, as a midfield player, as me being a defender, he was the hardest player to play against.
Really?
Yeah, definitely.
also, I mean, is it also to do with which spaces he would occupy? He seemed to pop up quite a lot, yeah. Because he could take it easily and give it to the right player quickly. He seemed to be quite hard to pin down, I thought.
He was, and he just had it. As I said, he could do it all. He could pass short, he could pass long, he would know when to pass. He'd always put the ball where you didn't want the ball to be. He'd always be in a position where you had the decision to make, should I go, should I stay? So
that's interesting. So his brain is as good as his technique?
I thought it was, yeah. I thought just the questions he asked you, and that was always, in my position, that was always my worry. You know, should I go, will I go, should I stay? And when you get caught in between, invariably, that's when you end up in trouble.
So you gamble if you're not sure because you haven't got enough information. Did you have a preferred choice, stay or go?
I'd always stay. Yeah, I'd always stay, especially...
Wait and see what... Wait, yeah. And just let the situation unfold and, yeah, see if there's still something I can do.
Yeah, and the best players, the Sheringham's, the Scholes, the Robbie Keane's and that, they'd always try and get you get in positions they weren't comfortable with or dragging you into positions whereby you didn't want to go. And that, it was a game of cat and mouse all the time. Or that's how I feel.
What an enjoyable way to spend your life. Literally a game of cat and mouse about, they're going, like, have a nibble, have it, I'm gone. And you're like, no.
And there was no, you know, there's no recovery.
Did you watch across Europe or England to say, you know, did you grow up watching Beckenbauer? Did you have people that you, Matt Maldini, that you went, I model myself, I see that?
More domestically, when I was growing up, I was a Rangers fan, so I was watching Terry Butcher and Richard Goff and what I thought was my position at the time. So they were my sort of role models growing up in terms of my position. And then, obviously, as you play in the Premier League, you're playing against and with really, really good players. And I was fortunate enough to play for Scotland, and some of the players you play against there and you see in the flesh and, you know, come up against in the flesh, then you get your horizons broadened again, and the Premier League became, you know, an international league as well as you know, my career got longer. So you kind of had the best mix there. You were getting international players in the domestic league, so it was a real, real good experience in terms of variety of players and cultures and how they played the position and played the role.
And the Villarreal experience, was their quality, was their intelligence just thrust at that team too soon? Because the achievement of being fourth should have allowed you a beatable team and into the Champions League. And during a group of six matches, you can learn so much. And I remember there was a point at which at Goodison, somebody's allowed to turn and go on to their better foot and their out of position. I thought, no. And the return leg is much... It felt like in the week there'd been a giant leap of learning right across the squad, and the second leg is so tight, and to lose it was so frustrating. Good team though, Villarreal were.
Yeah.
And they go into the semi-finals that year, don't they, I think?
They did, yeah. They were a great team, and I can always remember sitting in the canteen at Belfield at the time, which was an old-school training ground, and then watching the draw and Mikel Arteta being there, and he's saying, anyone but Villarreal.
No.
Anyone but Villarreal. And then obviously the draw's made, and you know, that's the team we get. And then turning, and we were a good team.
Yep.
You know, a good team, you know, you could say, look at the individuals and possibly not think the best players in the league, but a really good team. And we're thinking we've got a chance here, and playing them at Goodison is, as you said, that experience, that level of team, really good level of team, Raquel May, Forlan, Senna, top players, yeah, who are at the top of their game, and any slight misjudgment, you're punished.
Did it feel like that there was a little bit less margin for error than in your run-of-the-mill Premier League game?
Yeah, it was a different game. You know, I think European games always are. In my experience, I was fortunate enough to play in a lot of Rangers and less so at Everton, but they're sort of half and half between internationals and domestic games. I think it's definitely the best level from my experience. The European games, tactically and, you know, player-wise, they are the best games, and it did feel like that. It did. The atmosphere was fantastic, you can imagine. Champions League qualifier at Goodison, Villarreal, the opposition, so it was a massive build-up, and you did feel a little bit like, wow, this is a step up.
The fans made mega journeys down to get down to Castellón, and I remember David talking agonisingly about maybe a refereeing decision at the Magic Hour, which might have gone your way, and would have at least led to, I think, extra time, would it?
Yeah, that's right. Duncan scored a header from a corner when the game was 1-1 in the replay after having lost 2-1 in the initial game. So that would have taken it to extra time, and obviously the game would have been in the lap of the gods. So that was Kalina being the referee. So that was a tragic end to that Champions League campaign before it really got started.
He was never any good.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Before we close, we need to talk about more trivia, because I'm led to believe that you know the answer to who has the record for being the oldest outfield Champions League player, apart from his university goal scoring record, who also would be the last player to provide a goal scoring assist in a World Cup for Scotland. Are there other things I've missed, and can we name that player again?
No, but I've seemed to have a few oldest player records. That seems to be sort of my claim to fame for various different things. Maybe, I think oldest outfield international for Scotland, possibly for Rangers as well. So I think I picked up a few of those awards when I had, that last 5 years at Rangers that, was such a great end to my career when, I got back to go and play for the club that I supported, grew up and, and watched. And obviously had some good successes there. A lot of European games, had probably 20, 30 games in Europe against some great opposition. And, the Barcelonas, the Sevilles, the, Stuttgarts and Lyons, and, getting to the UEFA Cup final as well, which in reality now, looking at where Rangers are and, the difficulties that are ongoing there, it seems like a million miles away. 10 years ago it is now as well for that. So a lot of symmetry in terms of, 10 years ago since that UEFA Cup final, 20 years ago since the World Cup and playing in that, and 20 years ago since winning the Cup of Hearts. So it just seems to be...
If you take the humility aside, and I know that you're not being deliberately self-deprecating, but quite a number of times during this interview, you've talked about, maybe I wasn't good enough, or maybe I... So fair enough. But to go from somebody who went to Indiana saying, well, I wasn't good enough for football at that stage, to being, the oldest outfielder, playing until, winning trophies until an age where, at the time you were beginning your career, players weren't playing to that age. So, cutting to the bone, apart from what I could see in you, watching you as a player, particularly when you beat Aberdeen, brains, your match reading, your discipline about, I know how I'm going to win this game, or I'm going to win this battle. How did that happen? It's a big story you've told there.
Yeah, no, it isn't. When you think of it in those terms, I understand that. And I think, my nature is, obviously, as you've said there, probably that is my nature in terms of a little bit self-deprecating, but also being really competitive. When I get involved in a pitch or in a training session, then you want to win. And I think that's the biggest thing. You actually rise to the challenge and drag yourself up to what you need to do to try and find a way to win. And that's, you know, that was always my sort of gauge. As I went to America and then came back to Falkirk to play professionally, and playing with lads and training with lads and saying, I can do that, or I can, you know, I can rise to that challenge. And then going to Hearts and playing internationally, and then going into the Premier League and playing in the Premier League and playing internationally again, and then European ties, and then coming up to Rangers and being involved in a lot more European ties, and the challenges that go with that. I think, you know, probably being competitive by nature, and, you know, maybe not realising, you know, what you are capable of until you're put in that position, not pushing yourself to, you know, to try and achieve, but when you are actually confronted by it, rising to the challenge. And I think, you know, the competitive nature that's within you, I think, you know, that actually finding it and what enables you to do that, I think that's the key thing, you know, enjoying the struggles together.
Not every footballer or manager person that we meet in this series will admit to supporting a club. Yeah. Rangers is important to you, and you grew up as a supporter. Also, like, you travelled. That's what you do for your team. It's still what I feel like about Aberdeen. Would you have played for so long if your last club had been another one rather than Rangers? Did it help you extend in what you have to invest as a guy who's reaching 35, 36, 37, 38, that it mattered so much to you?
I think it was part of it. I think really fortunate as well to have a manager who trusted you at that age. You know, I think...
Is Walter again?
Walter, obviously, yeah. And, you know, less experienced managers are less... Maybe a manager with more resources probably wouldn't have trusted that, you know, me at that stage in my career as much as he did, and gave me the feeling that I could go on. You know, I was always signing short-term contracts and 6 months and then another year, and then another year, and then another year. So, you know, in my late 30s, still extending these contracts and having a manager who motivated you and trusted you. So if feeling that trust from someone, you want to repay it and you want to justify it. And obviously playing for Rangers, that was a massive part of it as well. Having gone through and watched the club when I was younger and being involved in that, my dad being a Rangers supporter, his dad being a Rangers supporter, and, you know, the whole village being a Rangers supporter village. So that's
a big thing to complete the loop of your career like that then.
It was, and you know, genuinely driving up every match day at the stadium. You know what Ibrox is like, you drive up and you see the stadium and you're going, wow, what a place. And then getting to play there and having a degree of success, you know, there and winning a few trophies. And
you know, that European season that you talked about, although you're saying it seems quite an achievement to have reached the UEFA Cup final, Europa League final now, you know, until the last group game, you were very nearly through in the Champions League as well. Amazing. I mean, the away result in Lyon was pretty astonishing. You'd been part of, as you say, you know, Sevilla was a different experience. Some Rangers fans still tell me that in living memory, maybe that home performance, that's Ibrox performance by Sevilla, is right up there. Okay. Kunati again.
Yeah.
The 0-0 at Old Trafford, 0-0 with Barcelona, whatever. But that run, 18 games you played. Now, you've already dispelled the notion there should be any tiredness. But an 18-game European season is some achievement with away wins and not clinging on, but an extra time night in Florence.
Yeah.
And a Scottish team beating somebody on penalties.
I know.
Shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, it was an unbelievable season, you know, looking back at it. In the time when you're in it, you know, you're in the continual progression of that season, you just look towards the next game. But with hindsight, when you actually look back, you know, that game you're talking about, Lyon, so the last game of the six at home against Lyon, and a draw or even a narrow defeat we would have gone through. And then Benzema decides to take it upon himself to get Lyon through, and, you know, as an individual performance, one of the best I've played against.
Really?
You know, in terms of what he did to us and how difficult he made for us.
They seem to draw you in and then go.
Yeah.
Which Scottish teams are perpetually tempted to say, our duty is to the fans, whereas every Italian would say, your duty is to the result.
Yeah.
The fans will come round when you get the result. We That's not in it. It might be in your blood, the way that you play, but it's not in our blood as a nation.
It's not in our blood, but Walter, you know, Walter's very pragmatic in those terms, and he's got a great love of Italian football, and that's his school of football you know, the Catenaccio and the, you know, the look after the defensive side of things first. That is particularly in Europe. Obviously, domestically, Rangers are expected to do a little bit more.
Yeah, but that night when when you're just going to yourself, percentages, yeah. percentages, percentages, get through, get through.
Yeah.
But there was just that feeling that it was a bit of a surge, and if the game's not coming around, frustration,
uh-huh.
and then they just went like, we'll have you.
Yeah, they did. They just cut us open, and it wasn't by design. We hadn't gone and opened up,
no.
and, you know, it was literally they drew us into positions, we made mistakes, and they punished us really, really well. So that was a real sore lesson, and the European campaign afterwards became very much, as we're talking about, very pragmatic, very sort of defensive. Even the home games were 0-0 or 1-0, or, you know, there was never a lot of opening up or a lot of trying to win the games as such. It was very much about, you know, staying in the game, staying in the tie, and finding a way to get through.
So there was a group spirit. So there was no, what you see sometimes now in the clubs, which I detest, the Europa League, we weren't rid of that, that Thursday league. That. There was an attitude about, like, we're gonna win this, or we're going to go through. Or...
I think it kind of crept up on us. I think, being honest initially, and Walt would be a better person to ask, I think the idea was to not stay in it too long. We went to Panathinaikos, Nacho scores a late goal, and we're still in the competition. So eventually, all of a sudden, you're in the last 32, I think it might have been, and, you know, it becomes a little bit closer, and then, you know, you get through the next tie, and you're like, oh, wait a minute, there might be something brewing here. But even going into the semi-final against Fiorentina, to actually think you're going to be in a European final, or you're actually going to make the final, as you said, you know, a Scottish team winning on penalties, it just doesn't happen. So probably still a bit sceptical in terms of actually what this journey is going to entail, and all the time in the background thinking we need to win the league, because Rangers hadn't won the league for a period of time, and that was Walter's number one priority, as you can imagine. So that's why he came back to Rangers from Scotland, was to win the league. So this was almost the distraction. The games are racking up. I think we played 68 games there.
And you've praised up Ben Samahu. I just want to trip back to, because, you know, his record and his trophies are very good in Madrid, but there's a lot of people who think that if you're a forward, and he's hit 20 plus goals for 6 of his 8 seasons, 25 in 6 of his 8 seasons, he's quicker than 50 goals than Ruud van Nistelrooy in the Champions League and Thierry Henry, and yet he does get pilloried a lot, whereas to me he's a 9.5, because he can play as a striker or he can drop back and do really subtle, intelligent things. So, I mean, that night you saw that, and you've watched him since. What's your Benzema view?
I just think, as you said, I just think underestimated in terms of the actual quality and the longevity of what he's done, you know, for centre-forwards to stay at that level for the period of time he's done at a club like that. You know, that's not easy to do. There's not many people, you know, other than the greats, who actually stay at the top level clubs, continually producing and navigate all the, you know, the pitfalls and, you know, the troubles that come with being at these clubs, both mentally and, you know, football wise. You know, it's a really difficult situation to live in, and he's done it. And, you know, watching the game at the weekend, you still see the quality that he's got, and I think he actually looks really, really good at this minute. He looks really fit, and he looks really motivated, and, you know, it looks like he's got the bit between his teeth, but just a player I've always admired. And
he'd one lucky night, let's just say it and get it out of there. Arsovin played.
Yeah, he did. And Timoshuk played, and there was
Timoshuk is such a he's one of the better players I've seen.
He was, definitely. And again, longevity and what he did, and Advocaat was the manager, and it was Zenit versus Bayern Munich. That was the other semi final. So we're thinking, naively obviously, you're thinking, well, if we get through, we'll play Bayern Munich. But as it turns out, Zenit put St Petersburg in a really, really good team. And in the final, which is at Manchester, you know, which is on a doorstep here, but thoroughly deserved to win the game. We were a really good two-legged team, a really good, you know, team. Again, with hindsight, looking back, who could navigate those two legs and could build the pressure on teams and could wait for the right opportunity. But in that one-off game, they were better than us, and, you know, it wasn't to be.
Was tiredness a big factor now that you look back at it?
No, not in the game. I don't think that was an excuse. I mean, they were better than us on the day. And as the season turned out, we, as I said, played 60-odd games. And I genuinely never felt tired once.
Then we'll wrap with, I need to know, because you must have come into closer contact with Messi than most. Messi played in the 0-0.
He did. He played in both games.
Then, from being on the same pitch as him for 180 minutes, tell me about Leo Messi.
Well, he's the ultimate for me, you know. all the arguments about who's the best and who's the best you've seen played against or ever seen. And for me, he's number one. So that, like, just to have the privilege of playing on the same pitch as him is a privilege that not many people get. And, you know, enjoying that. And the 0-0 game at Ibrox where, you know, it was anti-football and we were the, you know, the devil in terms of the Barcelona style of football and what we as Rangers were doing to try and get a result, you know, against Henri, Messi, Ronaldinho, Xavi, you know, all the top players. So you can imagine that there we weren't flavour of the month with them, but still admiring what they did, but also trying to get the job done.
Was he part of the pre-briefing?
Yeah. You know, if I can remember the meeting. And as I said, Walter wasn't massive on.
Mm-hmm. It was more about what you did.
More about what we did. But in the European games, obviously, treating the teams with respect and going through the individuals, the personnel, what they did, what they're likely to do, strengths and weaknesses, all the things that you do. And the Barcelona meeting was, it was 2 minutes. You know, it was 2 minutes in terms of almost a joke in terms of the quality of the player. This is what we're up against. This is what they'll do. All the best. And that's not an exaggeration, but that was Walter, because he relaxed you. He made you realise that I'm not putting this pressure on you. I'm not expecting to give you too much information. I'm not going to overload you. I'm going to make you go into the game relaxed. You know what your job is. I trust you to go and do it. So that was, and that's a bit simplistic, but that's how Walter managed.
Without a minute by minute, what when you were watching him those nights, what did you see? What were you looking for? Where didn't you want him to go? Well, how did you manage? I mean, over the two legs, it's disappointing to have lost in the camp now. Yeah. Over the two legs against that quality of side, the aggregate score wasn't too embarrassing.
It was just, the thing that stood out for me was his total lack of interest when we had the ball. You know, he would go and just find space when he had the ball, almost stand on the halfway line at the intersection, the halfway line and the touchline, and just wait for the ball, almost in that position that you don't see other players taking up. He got it in his head that this was the best place for me to just almost like wait till Rangers gave us a ball back, which, to be honest, wouldn't have been long, and get it to him, hopefully in some space. But
was that confusing to see?
It was very unusual, yeah, in terms of what you'd usually see in a game. And obviously that level of player, you know, you're intimidated anyway. You're going at the pitch against the best of the best. So when they start asking you questions, you know, a bit like we spoke about earlier, but players trying to drag you into different positions, you're starting to think, what's he doing there? What should I do?
Mm.
But
you didn't know at the time, but Alan McLeish had tried to sign him for Rangers. I'd tried for, you know, Alex's son had said, football manager dad says that there's this guy coming through, and Alec talked to Jan Wouters, who talked to Henk Ten Cat, and then they were like, no, we think he's too small, but there's this guy in Iniesta, we don't know what to do. Would he have made a career at Rangers, Messi?
I think he'd have been alright. I think he'd have managed to find a way to win.
Down Greg's of a lunchtime.
Yeah, that would have been a test.
But this is the last thing, without projecting how Steven Gerrard will do in Rangers, because that's a big set of factors that we don't know yet. When you were up against each other in all the derbies, you would have come up, if not directly up against him, you'd have played against him relatively.
He played in my first Merseyside derby. Stephen played in it, he got sent off. And that was the last game Everton won at Goodison in the league fixture. So it was 1999, and that was my first Merseyside derby, first experience, and I thought, this is all right, this is quite easy. And then, obviously, the record not great in the derbies, unfortunately. You know, Liverpool, great players, Steven Gerrard, a bit like Duncan, seemed to be one of those players who rose to those occasions, rose to the big game, came up, you know, when his team needed him. And
I like that.
That was, you know, that's how the derbies felt. It almost felt like he went in another gear in those games, and you were trying to catch, you know, trying to get close to that gear and trying to get to that level. And he, you know, for the longevity he had at Liverpool and what he did for that club, you know, I think that augurs well for Rangers in terms of, you know, his personality.
Well, feel free to laugh at me. I'm serious here. Some people give off, it isn't just what they do, some people give off an aura.
Uh-huh.
I've always felt, seeing him, meeting him, that he does that. And that's not coaching. That doesn't renew the transfer market.
Yeah.
That doesn't contrast against Celtic's greater reserves and Aberdeen's brilliant academy. But that can inspire people.
Definitely. I think, and it will. There's no doubt about that. He will inspire people because his nature. And you hear him speaking, you know, on TV, he's very good in terms of how he talks about the game, how he thinks about the game. And, you know, you couldn't fail as a player to be inspired by that. But he needs the tools to give him the best chance.
Grant.
And that's the bit that we don't know yet. So that's the bit that Celtic have got some really good weapons to use. So Rangers need to match that. Rangers need to give him the backing to allow him to have a fair fight.
David, I hope we've explained your career in this short time well enough. I hope you're proud of it when you listen back to it. I think it's a remarkable story. I was really eager to do this because it's nice to see successful, intelligent Scots.
It's been enjoyable and it's nice to recollect some of the things that, you know, have gone on in your career and where you've been and what you've done, and just discussing some of the situations that you encounter. You don't really know how you get a lot of the time.
Hopefully you enjoyed that big interview, which was first released as an exclusive to our socios 12 months ago. If you'd like to get these interviews on the first day that they're available, it's time for you to join us, to become a socio, and for only £2.99 a month, you will get an exclusive big interview, plus regular mini-documentaries, not only all ad-free, but all featuring me and bringing you interesting, funny, and sometimes scandalous things from Spanish football. Go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter to unlock our entire archive. That means that once you join, you will have a treasure trove of interviews with funny, elite, interesting, revelatory, top-class footballers. By joining us, you will help support this independent podcast. You will help to keep us on the road, interviewing people and sending that content for your delectation. If you go to the gym, you'll be slimmer. If you've got a dog, he or she will thank you. If you've got a TV, you can turn it off and listen to this instead.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.